Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. How about a cellist at your next party? Everything goes better with live Brahms and Dvorak, right? A report on a social media startup in Boston that's moving around the country that aims to marry classical music with young people. The club can't even handle this right now, folks. Also, how a broken dome is like a broken government in Washington, D.C., and bad online reviews produce more than just bad karma. Lawyers take on the Yelp effect. We'll also give you an update on the kidnapping crisis unfolding now in Nigeria this hour. But we begin with a statistic that no one would put on their college transcript.
We know the numbers. One in five of every one of those young women who's dropped off that first day of school, before they finish school, will be assaulted in her college years.
Vice President Joe Biden speaking about a White House effort to combat sexual assault on college campuses across the country. In addition to that one in five stat for women, 6% of men reportedly experience some form of sexual assault, and 70% of gay and transgender students report sexual harassment of some kind. Is this the culture of college campuses nowadays, or is it a law enforcement responsibility solidly at the feet of college administrators?
Hi, my name is Chrissy Davis. I'm calling from Hercules, California. How about training staff and teachers how to take reports, either anonymously or having them be like a safe person to go to?
We'd love to hear your story as well. From Tampa, one of you writes, universities will only play a role if pushed. Students should get the stats on the university's violence and or sex crimes and not go if they find the rates too high. Be responsible and remember that the university is selling something, and stopping their paycheck will get their attention. Reach out at thetakeaway.org. A lot of you are talking about this subject, but let's talk to a student now, Sophie Karasek. In your experience, has sexual assault been a tangible part of campus life for you at the University of California, Berkeley?
Unfortunately, yes. It's really come to define my experience here as a student at Berkeley. I was sexually assaulted as a first year at an off-campus event. And since my assault, I've connected with a lot of other students who have faced similar issues here at Cal. So unfortunately, it's been really common for me to hear, oh, that happened to me as well. And also to hear these stories of how the university has also mistreated them if they did try to come forward.
So what do you think the university's responsibility is here? And how would you rate the culture of tolerance at a place like UC Berkeley for sexual violence of any kind?
Unfortunately, it is quite common, and I think it's definitely the responsibility of Berkeley to keep its students safe. So often what you're having is students are coming forward to Berkeley and saying that they have been assaulted, and the university will say, okay, we'll look into that, but then nothing is really done. One of the main problems at Berkeley is that there isn't much of an investigative process at all. So you'll go and tell your story, but then nothing will come out of it. No one will contact you. There won't be a hearing, and then next thing you know, if you're lucky, your assailant will be put on disciplinary probation and maybe get a writing assignment as a punishment. So there definitely is a high level of tolerance for this sort of crime at Berkeley, and there has been for a very long time. And I mean, I definitely didn't expect it from Berkeley because I thought that it's a relatively progressive institution. I thought that that would play some sort of role in how they would handle this case. And I mean, I had no reason to distrust Berkeley before that. And Berkeley was also my dream school. I wanted to go to Berkeley more than anything. So once I came to Berkeley, and then first I was assaulted, and then to also be betrayed by my own university, I mean, really that the second part was much worse because I was never anticipating that that would happen, especially that there when there were four of us who actually reported the same guy who had assaulted all of us, and they didn't do anything.
We're talking with Sophie Karasik, who is now a junior at the University of California, Berkeley. And we should note that you're embroiled in a legal matter with the university right now. And we should note that Berkeley Chancellor Nicholas Dirks this year announced new hires to help investigate these kinds of crimes, new ways of helping victims navigate the reporting system. He said that victims will be allowed to appeal decisions in internal sexual misconduct cases. What do you make of that response by the university?
Sure. So I'm glad to see that they are taking additional steps. However, I think it's important to note that, well, the appeal right is actually something that we were supposed to have over a year ago. And we did draw attention to the fact that there was unequal treatment of survivors and assailants, that assailants could appeal decisions, but survivors couldn't. And they didn't do anything about this for a year. So first of all, I want to note that. And secondly, I think it's great that they're hiring more people, but up until this point, really what's been happening is when they hire these additional people, the people they're hiring don't have any interest in changing the culture that exists on campus. They don't have an interest in doing anything other than protecting the reputation of Berkeley.
Sophie, some folks listening, perhaps insensitive folks listening, might conclude that if your dream school let you down, why are you still there?
Well, I think that it really is a national problem. It's not if I were to go to another school that this problem wouldn't have happened to me. I mean, as you said at the beginning of your show, the statistic is 1 in 5 women will be assaulted while they're at college. So it's not if I had gone to another university, perhaps this wouldn't have happened to me. The tragedy is that certainly it is quite likely that if I were to go to another school that this would happen to me there too. So we have to address this on a federal level because it is so prevalent. And I am staying at Berkeley because, I mean, I still love the academics here and I have a lot of friends here and I wouldn't want to feel forced out by the university because of this. I would rather try to change it.
Sophie Karasik, class of 2015 at University of California, Berkeley. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Is there a federal role here? Vice President Biden seems to think so, and so do lawmakers who want to make the atmosphere on college campuses more transparent for parents and students. Joining us now, Congresswoman Jackie Speier from California's 14th District, not far from UC Berkeley. Welcome, Congresswoman.
Great to be with you, John.
So I'm a dad with 3 college-bound daughters and 2 college-bound sons. How do you protect people like Sophie Karasik with a federal initiative?
Well, to make it even more personal, I have a sophomore in college who's a young co-ed. So there are a number of things we can do. One is require annual climate surveys. We've done that in the military. It creates automatic accountability. The legislation that I'm going to be introduced, known as the HALT Act, will also require disclosure, public disclosure of all resolution agreements. Those are the agreements that the Department of Education makes with the university after there's been a complaint relative to Title IX, and most of these complaints are filed under Title IX. More money for investigators, Title IX investigators. The legislation is also going to provide for posting signage in public places of what the rights are for individuals who are raped, what their opportunities are for filing complaints, and where they can get help. Beyond that, we also need training. We need training of local law enforcement, training of the first responders, the healthcare providers, so that these victims have a shot at getting the kinds of resolutions they should have.
Congresswoman, I wonder if you'd share some of the background here in that, you know, obviously you're aware of what goes on and you're a mother of a college student. But it seems as though some of this initiative came out of the fight in Congress over getting the military to be more accountable about sexual assault and the military using the argument that, hey, we're doing as well as college campuses. Can you share that a little bit?
Actually, that's precisely true. I've been working on sexual assault and rape in the military now for 3 years, and oftentimes the brass from the Pentagon would come to me and say, well, hey, look, our numbers are better than college campuses, as if that was a basis on which to somehow herald the disaster that exists in the military as it relates to this issue. And as I looked at the issue, I realized they are parallels. You have closed systems in both cases. You have internal law enforcement. You have in the military a uniform code of military justice. On college campuses, you have a code of moral conduct. And as a result, The administrations in both institutions have swept these cases under the rug. And the parallels are really stunning and at the same time chilling.
But is there a national, it's not really a parallel in the sense that we tolerate binge drinking. We love to go to movies about people being kind of crazy on college campuses. This goes way back to toga parties and that sort of thing. And if we were to look at the U.S. News and World Report college rankings and maybe see signs of a school being a party school, is it possible that that's actually capturing some of the tolerance you're talking about without really showing the statistics that parents and students maybe should know more about?
Well, in fact, I have authored a letter that's a bipartisan letter in the House that was signed by more than 13 members to U.S. News and World Report, asking them to include as one of the issues in their ranking the status of whether or not there's an appropriate level of oversight on college campuses. Do they handle sexual assault cases promptly? Interestingly enough, the top four ranked universities on the U.S. News and World Report ranking, all four of them are either in the process of responding to Title IX complaints that have been filed or have just recently resolved Title IX complaints. And Title IX is the umbrella law that provides that in education, everyone should be free from discrimination.
And as we noted, the statistics also involve men and gays on campus. You know, Vice President Biden said right here at the top of the hour, we know the numbers. I mean, I have a lot of respect for Vice President Biden, but I didn't know those numbers. I don't think we know the numbers. Do you think we know the numbers?
No, I don't think we know them. When 20% of the college co-eds are going to have an experience with either attempted sexual assault or sexual assault at some point during their college career, that is a frightening number. And it's the first question whenever you go on a college tour, it's the first question that is asked by parents. And I heard it every school that we went to. What are you doing about sexual assaults on campus? And they would always say, well, we have blue phones, we have this. You know, the truth is, I don't think any of us knew how widespread it really is.
You know, we talked with Sophie Karasek at the top of the hour, and she had an experience at UC Berkeley. We don't want to make this about UC Berkeley because, as she said very responsibly, this is a national problem. Can you assure us this is indeed a national problem?
Oh, absolutely. It's a national problem. I met with Sophie. I met with Chancellor Dirks. And I want, and I said this to the chancellor, I want UC Berkeley to become the model for the rest of the country as to how you handle sexual assault on campus. And there has to be zero tolerance. One of the young co-eds I talked to at UC literally was not only after she filed the complaint and had a stay-away order, the assailant violated it. The second year, she was put in the same dorm with this assailant on the same dorm floor. So that shows a true lack of recognition of how pervasive and how serious the problem is and how most universities have basically not responded appropriately.
Representative Jackie Speier, Democratic Congresswoman representing California's 14th Congressional District. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
So from the possibility of online transparency about campus life to the less transparent information from anonymous online reviewers of restaurants and retailers, we want to know, do you rely on online reviews when you evaluate a business?
This is Matt in Portland, Oregon. I do always check the online reviews before I make any major purchase, but I also do try to assess the intelligence and any possible biases of the reviewers rather than taking them at face value.
This is Anna from Los Gatos, California. As a business owner, every time I get a 1 or 2 star review on Yelp, it really affects me personally. I really look at it and see if there's changes I can make.
We'd love to hear your review. Nice reviews. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave us a comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Hundreds of protesters on the streets of Nigeria's capital, Abuja, this week signify a growing crisis over the fate of 129 kidnapped girls, according to the government. But others say it's more like 187 girls being held captive for more than a week by the terrorist group Boko Haram.
We really want to plead with government, international community, to come and help us. We want these girls rescued so that even the younger generation will have confidence in the government that they can help us.
That's a mother of one of the kidnapped girls. Protesters say the government is not doing enough to free them, and now there are reports that the girls are being forced into marriages with the militants. Here's Nigeria's Interior Minister Abba Moro answering BBC questions about the government response to the crisis.
Efforts have been made to locate these girls and rescue them.
But are you telling me then that the military has not located them yet?
If the military divulges its operational mechanism, I mean, between me and you, you will understand that it's like giving away the security of those persons that are involved.
Joining me now is Alexis Okewo, a freelance journalist based in Lagos. She has reported on the kidnappings for NewYorker.com. Alexis, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It does seem as though this event that's unfolding in Nigeria has the potential of truly shaking up almost everything that's going on in Nigeria right now, from the confrontation with the terrorists Boko Haram to just the basic relationship between Nigerians and their own government.
Exactly. I mean, the crisis has already taken a toll on the economy. It's taken a toll on the political relations. And yes, now it's really fractured the relationship between Nigerians and their government. A lot of Nigerians don't place the same amount of trust they used to in their leaders.
Where does it stand at this point in terms of what the government says it's doing and what people, particularly the protesters who are on the streets, believe is going on?
Well, the problem is that the government is not saying much. We've heard very little from President Jonathan. We've heard various senators say that a drastic military action needs to be taken. But all we're hearing from the military is that a search is ongoing and that things have intensified. But we haven't seen any results, and we haven't heard really anything significant since they said right after the kidnapping that they had discovered or rescued most of the girls, but they actually hadn't. And so protesters are really questioning if a military operation is even happening, if there's a serious effort to get the girls right now, which is a pretty terrifying question.
What is the perspective of parents and educators in Nigeria? What voices have you heard there?
Well, the parents are obviously devastated, and they really feel failed by their government, and they feel really disillusioned. They try to take things into their own hands, but it's impossible to go after terrorists unarmed. And educators, you know, I mean, they're feeling very regretful because, I mean, it was the decision of local education officials in the town of Chibok to open the school briefly, even though there had been attacks in other schools, so that the girls could take the final exams, and it backfired. The girls were kidnapped. And so I think parents and educators are feeling guilt and devastation and loss and just wondering why they haven't heard more from their government on what they're doing to get these girls.
What about the vulnerability of young women, young girls, young students? There have been students who've testified, who escaped from the custody of Boko Haram, and their voices are being heard.
Yes. I mean, you know, unfortunately, we've heard in the past that when Boko Haram has kidnapped women and young girls, that they've used them as sex slaves and they've forcibly taken them as wives and forced them to become pregnant. And so we fear that this fate may await these girls. We already know that they were forcing the girls to perform tasks like cooking and cleaning and gathering firewood and water. And so it's a huge fear that these militants will force these girls to do even more horrific things.
In your reporting, what have you heard from people who actually observed the captivity before they escaped?
Yes, I spoke to one girl, Deborah, and it was a terrifying experience. You know, at least 200 girls were taken by these militants into a sort of bush, a couple of villages away in a remote area. And, you know, already the militants were just sort of telling them to be patient, and they were already ordering them to do certain tasks, but it was unclear what was the end goal. And so the girl I spoke to was able to escape mere hours after she was taken to one of Boko Haram's camps. And now things are unknown. We hear various eyewitness reports that maybe these girls have been paired off with the militants, but nothing can be confirmed right now.
Are there any specific demands from Boko Haram aside from their incomprehensible mission to return Nigeria to a pre-modern state?
Yes. I mean, when Boko Haram first started over a decade ago, its aim, it said, was to have an Islamic State, to have a return to a pure Islamic society free of political corruption. Now that aim has become completely warped. We don't know what they want besides to create fear and terror, because they now say they're waging jihad and that, you know, they're committing a huge amount of violence in the name of jihad. But it's unclear as to what they actually want now besides just wreaking havoc.
Alexis Okewo, no one would suggest that the government of Nigeria condones the capture of young women. But I'm wondering, and again, theorizing here, is it possible that part of the hesitation and ambivalence of the government in its response, or seeming ambivalence of the government in its response, relates to the fact that perhaps people in the Nigerian government, in, majority Islam Nigeria, believe that the education of women is somehow a controversial issue and that Boko Haram has them on a political issue that has some sensitivity here?
Well, first, I mean, the country is not majority Islam. It's I would say half-half, a split between Christian and Muslim. And the federal government is currently a Christian Southern leadership. So I don't think it's much about not believing education should be for women. I think it's more about that there's been a long practice of the government looking the other way. But because this is happening in the remote Northeast, the government has been able to not pay enough attention to what's going on, as long as it's been this isolated insurgency. But now, as it creeps into the capital, Abuja, and it now as more horrific acts keep happening, I think it's going to be forced to stop looking the other way.
Alexis Okewo is a freelance journalist based in Lagos. She recently reported on the kidnappings, where you can read her reporting at thenewyorker.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Northern Ireland, revelations about a 1972 murder uncovered by Boston College students is the reason that Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams has spent a night in jail and under questioning by police. The Boston College History Project focused on the unrest in Northern Ireland in the last century, and the revelations came from interviews with people who have allegedly shed some light on the fate of a woman, Jean McConville, a mother of 10, who was abducted in West Belfast more than 40 years ago. Irish journalist and author Ed Maloney is a former director with the Boston College Project. Welcome, Ed.
Glad to be here, John.
So what are these revelations, and describe just how inflammatory the case of Miss McConville was back in 1972?
Well, Jean McConville was a widowed mother of 10 young children who was taken away by the IRA in December 1972 on the basis that she was suspected of passing on information about IRA members in her area to the British Army. And after a few days of imprisonment by the IRA across the border, she was taken to a beach in a very picturesque part of Ireland called Carlingford Loch. And at the edge of an already excavated grave, a bullet was fired into the back of her head. And there she lay, with no one knowing where she was, least of all her family, until 2003, when she was discovered purely by chance by a man walking on the beach. And the killing has taken on the proportion of being a major scandal, partly because of the very pathetic nature of her case, the fact that she was a woman and a mother of 10 young children, but also because of allegations that the order to disappear her, as it was called, was given by Gerry Adams, who was then the commander of the IRA in Belfast. And if he is put on trial, if he is charged with this murder, and if he ends up in a court, then the credibility of the peace process within the Republican community, the IRA community, is going to take a major hit. So an awful lot hangs on what happens in the next day or so.
Well, we should note that Gerry Adams says he was innocent of any part of the murder, which doesn't speak directly to the idea that he might have given the order when he was in command. How do you reconcile the fact that, as you've noted, Gerry Adams is believed to be responsible for the peace process itself, the ending of the so-called Troubles in Northern Ireland, and yet there's this cruelty of Miss McConville being abducted, her children just left to fend for themselves on the streets and no information being given as to what would happen to her. She was believed to be an informant. How do you reconcile those?
Well, it was worse than that. In fact, lies were told about what had happened to her. There were stories spread around that she had run off with a British soldier, for example, which was a complete lie, and other stories that she was still alive but had abandoned her family. But, you know, people changed. Michael Collins changed. He did a deal with the British. He's done something the same. But Michael Collins also killed people in the most cruel way. And so, you know, it's not unusual. And it doesn't necessarily mean that a person who does that sort of thing and changes is a hypocrite who should be condemned. In fact, you know, the peace process, which is very much a tribute to American diplomacy, because the two American presidents devoted an enormous amount of their energy and time into making sure that the thing worked, shows that, you know, that you can actually remove the causes of violence and get people to sit down and settle things in an amicable and peaceful way. That has happened here. But the problem now is that by raking up this past, this very ugly part of the past, the damage that could be done both to Adams and to the peace process, you know, is very, very considerable indeed. And I think it's maybe now giving pause for thought amongst those in the Department of Justice who so eagerly cooperated with the British when these subpoenas were first sent to Boston College. I think they may now beginning to realize that a major mistake was made.
The fate of Gerry Adams in British custody linked with the fate of the peace between Northern Ireland and Britain. Irish journalist and author Ed Maloney, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
So if Americans need physical proof that their federal government in Washington, D.C. is broken, all they have to do is take a peek inside the U.S. Capitol.
There's some 1,000 to 1,300 cracks.
There's 1,300 cracks
in the exterior cast iron.
So be careful of your shoulders and your cameras particularly.
And those cracks represent water leaks. And if you look carefully at the rotunda above us, you can see where water has penetrated. You can see the rust stains.
And if we don't do it now, it's going to be more expensive later.
I wonder if they were wearing hard hats there. That's from a media tour looking at structural problems in the Capitol Dome that not even the Tea Party can argue away. The 150-year-old U.S. Capitol Dome needs a $60 million restoration between now and 2015, a project that has become an inevitable symbol, just like the dome itself, of broken government in the United States. Joining me now, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick on Capitol Hill. Todd, are you wearing a hard hat?
Cracked, but still standing, the Capitol Dome. And maybe that's a lot like Congress itself. Hey, John, yep, in the Capitol right now.
And this $60 million restoration will mean that visitors to Washington will see the scaffolding going up and that dome will not be visible for a while.
That's exactly right. And the project is in two phases. And we had a nice viewing just last evening with the architect of the Capitol, Stephen T. Ayers. Two phases. Phase one, John, they've erected a massive cloth donut on the inside of the famous Capitol Rotunda. That's to catch any debris that falls during this giant construction and renovation project. Now, the Capitol Rotunda is going to stay open to tourists. People can still go through there. But this giant donut, we got a picture on the website if you want to get a sense of what I'm talking about. It's about 120 feet across. It's huge. And it's designed to catch debris up to 500 pounds that might fall
gonna,
cast iron.
They're
going to
catch. They're going to catch this stuff and sell it as souvenirs and pay down the deficit, right?
People might buy it. And when you see the photos of the condition of the Capitol, you'll get to understand why they're doing this. So that's phase one is the interior. They're done with that. And there's some scaffolding that went up and scaffolding that's come down inside the rotunda. Outside in the dome is where the big work is starting right now. There's scaffolding going up as we speak. It's not occluding the dome yet. But for the next 2 years, that Capitol dome, that famous icon, is going to be in a cage. All 7,000 cast iron tons of it. John, they haven't touched it. They haven't repaired it in any significant way since 1960. And they've done small repairs trying to fill in the big cracks in the cast iron, but they haven't really renovated. That's why they're doing this.
I know that we could talk for probably 2 hours about every single renovation that's been done back to like 1814 when the British, you know, burned Washington.
Yep.
But let's not go there. if you go to the Capitol, really, in the last decade, there's been a lot of work done on the Capitol. There's a renovation going on at the Supreme Court right now. What's the track record for getting this stuff done on time? And are there any worries here?
Yeah, the track record is a little scary, especially in lean budget times. The biggest construction project recently is the Capitol Visitor Center. It's underground, sort of in a bunker, to handle all the 2.5 million tourists who come through the Capitol each year. It's beautiful. John, it was completed back in 2008.
It is gorgeous.
It is three years late and $350 million over budget. So people are really scared. So you worry about cost overruns and not finishing on time. But I asked a conservative Republican about this, somebody who'd be really concerned about cost overruns, Republican Senator John Hoeven. He's the senior Republican on the committee that's handling the money for this project. Listen to what he said about getting this thing done on time.
Sure, you have to have it all done for the inauguration. So we've got a hard deadline there. So, I mean, we've planned this out. And I think, we've been very careful to talk to the architect, and he understands it. Not only does the timeline have to be met, but, you know, the budget.
I detect a little enthusiasm there. He's anticipating a Republican inauguration in 2016.
Yeah, look, he's all for it, and pretty much everybody was. In terms of Capitol Hill renovations and Washington renovations, $60 million is a song. It's considered not that expensive. The Washington Monument was under scaffolding for over 3 years. They had a renovation there. They took the scaffolding down, and John, then that earthquake 2 summers ago, they had to put it right back up to repair the Washington Monument. They're hoping not to do that. Inauguration 2017 is the hard deadline to have the scaffolding down, have it all cleaned up.
And if they get it done by 2015, they can go to work on renovating your kitchen. Todd Zwillich, thanks so much.
You bet.
Todd Zwillich, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Okay, picture this now. This is the world of a younger, nerdier Sam Bodkin.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river.
My love of the Beatles was truly one of the defining characteristics of my personality. That's not an exaggeration.
Now, picture yourself in the house of a cellist. His records are different. His music opens your eyes.
And then, when I was 19 years old, I was in the basement of my best friend, and he himself is a world-class cellist. We grew up, a few doors down from one another. And his string quartet was working on Beethoven's Opus 133, Grosse Fuga, and he put it on.
Young Sam Bodkin experienced Beethoven's monster of all string quartets, a savage brawl between hellishly dissonant instrumental voices, wandering lost in heights and depths, clashing with one another in variant patterns at every irregular turn, wrote German novelist Thomas Mann of the extraordinary piece of chamber music Bodkin encountered in that basement. And Sam Bodkin was suddenly in heaven.
It was so fundamentally at odds with everything that I had sort of expected classical music to be without ever having engaged with it, and it just completely, obliterated my universe.
So Sam immediately wanted to share his revelation with other young people whose playlists ranged from Beck to Kanye to Radiohead to Beyoncé, with nary a Bach or Beethoven track in the mix. And noting the digital savvy of his peers and an ample supply of amazing classical musicians eager to party, Bodkin came up with the Boston-based social media startup GroupMuse, which led him to a partner, Tony Rudell, the station manager for WCRB, the somewhat sedate classical music radio station in Boston, also eager to find ways to party a little harder and younger. Bodkin and Rudell, let's just say, they're now a duet, making beautiful music together, with Rudell on bass and Bodkin singing the high notes.
GroupMuse is a social network that directly connects classical musicians in the area to people who have living rooms in the area so that the community can sort of organically generate its own chamber music house parties, which we call GroupMuses. Each event we call a GroupMuse because it's a kind of a strange entity. It's an evening that's as social as it is musical, though the musical portion is taken extremely seriously. When the music is playing, everyone's sort of attentively respective. But then the social aspect is equally as important, which means that during intermission and afterward and beforehand, it's a house party. It's like truly a house party.
That's Sam Bodkin, founder and CEO of GroupMuse. And given Tony Rudell the surplus level of virtuosity among string players, I mean, this is like the equivalent of showing up at somebody's living room, and there's Jimi Hendrix sitting on the couch.
Well, it was we hosted one here at WCRB last week in our performance space, and we turned what is a beautiful recording studio into a living room in essence, and I was pleased that these young musicians came in and the first words out of their mouth were "Holy cow." Made us feel good. We had 20-something-year-olds sitting on the floor, sitting on couches, drinking beer and listening to Brahms. And they played the first two movements. It was so amazing. And I've been going to concerts for a long time. I've never seen this happen. I found myself talking to the pianist, and between movements of a piece of music, he was about to go back and play, and he was drinking a beer. And we were chatting about totally unrelated things. And he said, "You know what? Listen, I'm going to go play the third movement." And he walked away. And it redefines the entire experience. And that is what I love about this. The concert-going experience has not really changed in 200 years. And this group of 20-somethings has said, "You know what? Maybe it's time to redefine the experience." And I must tell you, we are thrilled to be involved with Sam and his group.
You know, if Beethoven, you know, was alive today, he would probably recognize some of the feel of these house parties in the kinds of chamber music concerts that you could imagine going to among the upper crust in Vienna and elsewhere in Europe in the 1820s. Right, Tony?
Well, it's not only that. There's a sense of, if you will, take it to another level, like a great jazz jam session or a great rock and roll jam session. Watching musicians of this quality, and I will tell you the quality we had the other night was extraordinary. Watching them have fun playing the music is of that earlier era, as you point out, John. It truly is the going back to the notion that classical music is entertainment and not this sort of academic thing you need to respect. The music needs to be respected and admired and appreciated. But, you know, Sam and I also share this love of the Beatles. And I respect and admire those songs the way I respect and admire Schubert Lieder. So I think you're right on target, John, with the question. It is reminiscent of the house parties or the salons, if you will, of another era. The vibe is probably a little bit different. I don't think, you know, because of the way people dressed, they were sitting on the floor back in the 18th century.
But still, I agree with what you said. Beethoven would probably be more uncomfortable and more weirded out by, you know, the BSO concerts, you know, in Orchestra Hall than he would be at some of these parties.
Well, if you think about it, take an orchestra anywhere in this country, anywhere in Europe, and look at the way they're presenting a concert. If you took away the electric light bulbs, it would be the way it was in 1820. Now, some of the repertory has changed, but there's no basic difference. The conductor comes out in tails and white tie. The orchestra is in black and white. And they sit on a stage and they play music. And there is a place for that. We are not saying, and I think Sam would agree with me, we are not saying that should be jettisoned. But this kind of excitement and entertainment and making the music accessible to so many people. There were people in our space on Friday night who I don't think have ever been to a classical concert. And you know what? They had a good time.
They had a great time.
So we came into this segment with one of the late Beethoven quartets. You guys call it. What do we go out with?
I was sort of thinking the slow movement to Kürtchel 533. It's a piano sonata in F major by Mozart, and such a gem.
I never thought the guy would be more musically nerdy than I am, but he is.
This piece, it's unbelievable. It's like, it sounds equal parts Bach, Mozart, and Wagner. It's so chromatic in the middle. I mean,
could we just hear it? Sam Bodkin, founder and CEO of Group Muse, and Tony Riddell, station manager for WCRB, the classical radio station of our partner WGBH. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, John.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
This program, The Takeaway, turned 6 years old this spring. And really, how did we survive? I mean, here was a typical audience comment at thetakeaway.org in the early going. Paul called us the taste away. I'd say it's an experience akin to hearing Adolf Hitler deliver MLK's I Have a Dream speech. Is there a number of negative comments that has to be reached before the plug is pulled on this atrocity? So I was Hitler. Great moment in a long career. But then I'm sure Ira Glass never got compared to Hitler. It's a milestone he'll never experience. We slogged through the negative comments and made it to today. But how did the Topanga, California Mexican restaurant Abuelitas survive this two-star Yelp review that got turned into performance art?
I was here for Mother's Day, accompanied by my teenage son and my husband, and had the misfortune of having an idiot waiter. He brought flowers for the moms at 3 of the 5 tables. And, of course, I wasn't one of them. And now I'm writing this bad review. How insensitive. Do you think the other 2 tables of moms weren't going to notice?
That's actress Amanda Lee Cobb reading a Yelp review as entertainment. So glad she never saw the takeaway.org in the early days. Well, soldiering on, like us, Abuelitas is still in business and will be open today from 4. But other businesses have suffered from these anonymous negative reviews, and now lawyers around the country are fighting over whether such reviews constitute slander or protected free speech. Alex Goldmark, senior producer for WNYC's New Tech City, welcome to the Bruised and All Takeaway.
Hello.
You know, this online review thing and libel laws and the questions of how you hurt people with reviews, this occurred to me immediately when comments started coming in, when Yelp started putting the stars and Amazon and everything. It seems to me that this would have immediately been a legal issue.
Right. And so I think businesses may have hesitated from making it a legal issue right away, because when they go after someone because they don't like a comment about something they did, it only draws more attention to that bad thing they did. It's called the Streisand effect. And that is named after Barbara Streisand because of a famous case where she tried to get a photo of her house taken down from a website. And before the lawsuit, 10 people had downloaded this photo of her house. And after the lawsuit, John, 500,000 people had downloaded it. So obviously it backfires when you try to.
It rained on her parade, huh?
Yes. And you know, now I know what her house looks like because I've seen the photo too, all because of this lawsuit.
Try to ignore the negative clippings. You know, any press is good, but don't emphasize the negatives.
Right. And so what we're seeing now is essentially business owners are feeling such a hit because one bad comment, they tell me, adds up to 10 good ones. And an online business can really, really suffer from what they feel are bogus bad reviews. There's a lawyer, Rennie Delaney, and he has been hearing from a lot of small businesses who want him to sue Yelp. And what he says is it's just a dangerous place out there for small businesses.
What you're seeing is, you know, scores of people who feel that they've been maligned unfairly and that there is really nothing they can do about it.
But don't businesses have to sit there and take it? I mean, isn't it sort of they live or die on customer reaction? Customer's always right?
No. Some of these customers aren't even real customers. That's the claim here. Rennie Delaney comes into this picture, who we just heard from, because of a case of a carpet cleaner in Virginia. His name is Joe Hadid, and he's pretty well known in the Washington, D.C. area. He pays to advertise. He works on his reputation really hard, and then he gets a slew of negative comments on Yelp, and he says that's hurting his business. But the thing is, they're anonymous, and he has a hunch that they're false.
There was a negative review from New Jersey, where we don't do business. We checked the reviews against our records, and we couldn't identify any real customers that matched the reviews.
What's the burden of proof here? Does he have to prove that they are wrong? Does Yelp have some responsibility to screen and vet the content that goes out there? Do people, if they're anonymous, I mean, that seems invalid on its face.
Well, Yelp tells me via email that there is a value to anonymous commenting. Imagine if you want to post a review about a plastic surgeon, right, or a divorce lawyer.
Or reporters protect their anonymous sources.
Right. So there's a value to anonymous speech. This is a value that we have in this country in general. And Yelp says that they do some checking to make sure in certain cases that there isn't defamation, like seeing if one IP address is posting many bad reviews. But it's a real serious legal question. Where do you draw the line between how easy it should be to out an anonymous commenter or how hard it should be? And so this case, the Joe Hadid carpet cleaning case, is heading to the Virginia Supreme Court, and they're going to decide, should Hadid be able to sue Yelp and get the names of those anonymous commenters by saying one of them was from New Jersey and I don't clean carpets in New Jersey? Or should he have to do more and prove, no, 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 that thing that he is saying in the comments, that's actually false. Here's some documented evidence.
So on the one hand, Hadid is advocating for an issue, a free speech issue. On the other hand, he's trying to save his business. I guess the question for you is, which is he more likely to succeed at? Getting rid of the effect of those negative ads or upholding a principle in law and in speech and freedom?
Well, his lawyer, Rennie Delaney, he puts it in a way that frames two fundamental rights going head to head.
What's at stake in this case in the larger picture is two competing, I guess, rights. And, you know, one of the rights is the right to free speech and the right to speak anonymously. And the other right is the right to protect your reputation.
And the question is, can you do both, right? Probably not in every case.
Well, and a lot of businesses can't afford to do this at all. I mean, they would go out of business if they hired a lawyer even at step one.
Right. And there's a bigger problem here that the lawyers for Yelp say. And they say that even just bringing a case, whether it works or not, that's actually a problem on itself too, right? Because you can stifle speech just by the threat of a lawsuit. And so here's Scott Michaelman. He's the attorney for Public Citizen, and he represents Yelp.
Just by contacting a consumer and telling him or her, you must take your criticism down, the company has succeeded in intimidating the consumer and possibly deterring other consumers from posting criticism of that company.
Do you think that's true, that if you could get sued for a response, a Yelp review, that that would dry up the reviews and Yelp would sort of go away?
Can I answer that with a story?
Sure.
So there's the case of Jen and John Palmer in Utah. And this case is pretty extreme. John Palmer, he's trying to buy a Christmas present for his wife. And he picks something out online at a company called Clear Gear. It's a desktop trinket, like a dolphin that spins around. And it never shows up. So they want their money back. And then they complain, and they doesn't get their money back. And eventually they post a negative review. Well, the company says, hey, you're not allowed to do that because of some fine print in our terms of service, and we're going to charge you $3,500 for posting that negative review. Jen Palmer, she is the one who posted it, and she just hunkered down and had to fight it. But that's unusual.
I've never regretted leaving that review. If things were different, I probably would have left exactly the same review, even knowing what was going to happen later.
And in fact, it appears that Clear Gear didn't even have that clause in there early enough to make it enforceable when the Palmers bought it. That gets a little complicated. We go into it in a longer story we do on the New Tech City podcast. But the takeaway of all of this is, companies are trying lots of crazy things to stop people from posting comments. And all of these are now going through the court system to see what tools does a business have to protect its reputation and which of them step too far in infringing on our right to speech.
Alex Goldmark, senior producer for WNYC's New Tech City podcast. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We play some of your negative reviews of this program, but we got to go. Goodbye. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Introducing reputation scoring for businesses. Learn more at 1-800-REPUTATION or at Reputation.com. TiVo, delivering cable TV and internet TV together in one searchable and unified viewing experience. Available at TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.